Good morning, and a bracing, cool, bright morning it is. And what a great place to be on this morning with an amazing opportunity. And I am humbled, so I'm not going to say much because I don't want to make a fool of myself and some of the most gracious, intelligent, dedicated, wonderful people I know. Well, first of all, thank you again to the Aldo Leopold Foundation, to the Arboretum, to the Johnson Foundation that co-sponsored last night's event, to the Center for Humans and Nature, where I work, along with the Leopold Foundation. I have both my bosses here today. That's why I'm going over there. For hosting this gathering, obviously the Society of Environmental Journalists for bringing us all together. I'll briefly say that my own story intersects with the Arboretum, which I won't go into in great depth except to say when I started graduate school in 1981, having been influenced by people like Aldo Leopold and Wendell Berry here in Madison, I moved into a house just to the west of the Arboretum of a wonderful retired professor of English literature and a poet named Madeline Doran. She lived just to the west of the Arboretum, and every day I would walk into campus through the Arboretum. And really, that was my most important education that I received in my years of study at the University of Wisconsin. It was not the classes I was walking to. It was the landscape I was walking through, from which I learned a lot more than I ever realized at the time. So I also feel very connected here. I went on to do work, of course, on Aldo Leopold. That was the focus of my graduate studies. And like most of us and most people around the world, I knew of Aldo Leopold only through his writings in a Sand County Almanac. I didn't know Aldo Leopold. I knew, in quotations and capital letters, the author of a Sand County Almanac. It was only later that I got to know Aldo Leopold through the writings of some of the people here on our panel, through getting to know the family, through living in the basement of our library on campus where Leopold's papers were. And I have had my own opportunity to watch Leopold's legacy grow, expand, evolve in exciting and different and unexpected ways over now 30 years. And that's the theme of our conversation this morning. We have a really awesome opportunity this morning, and it just got even better, because you'll notice there's four people at the panel, not just three. That's because Carl, there on the end, happened to be visiting. Carl is Nina's younger brother. Carl's only 90 years old. So I'm very briefly going to introduce these folks. I think most of you know them by name or reputation anyway. So this is going to be quick and dirty. Nina Bradley is Aldo Leopold's third child and oldest daughter, and has been, for many of us, how can I say it, the godmother, adopted grandmother, our friend, our mentor, our guide, our provider of lunches, our dispenser of wine for so long that we almost take it for granted that Nina will always be there and will always offer wine whenever we show up at her door. Next to her is Wendell Berry. I think that's enough of an introduction. Next to Wendell is another son of Wisconsin, Mike Dombeck, perhaps best known for being the chief of the Forest Service during the Clinton years. But he has had an amazing career with his starting off, again, being born in northern Wisconsin, gaining his PhD, actually, at Stevens Point in fisheries biology, going on to be one of the most tenured of our land management professionals in the federal government. He is now back at Stevens Point after having left Washington and returned to his home territory. And on the far end, not in your program, but visiting all the way from Ithaca, New York, is Carl Leopold. And Carl, through his career in botany, has also followed in parts of his father's footsteps. Carl happened to be visiting this week to work with Nina. I love this. This is so Leopoldian. Some years ago, Nina and her siblings published a paper on phenology using the records that their father had worked with back in the 30s and 40s, and that Nina has kept up in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. They published, it was a very important study because it was one of the first to use data like this to track the impacts of climate change on natural phenomena. Well, that paper is now 10 years old, so she thought they needed to update it, so she called on Carl to come out and have a talk about it. I don't know if you got around to doing your work, but maybe they can talk about this. And I'll conclude by saying what we have here is a representative of three very different but related dimensions of Leopold's legacy. Again, most of you know Aldo Leopold through his writings in a San County almanac. I hope after your several days in Madison, those of you who are visiting, you realize how broader and deeper that legacy is. So, and in fact, what we have here is a representation of three different dimensions: the personal legacy of Aldo Leopold through his children, the professional legacy of Aldo Leopold, and I hope Mike can speak to that theme, and then the literary, cultural, and historical legacy of Aldo Leopold. And Wendell is better equipped to talk to that, I think, than just about anybody I know. So we're going to start off with Nina. And we'll try to do this in a way that will leave some time for questions. And thank you all for coming out on a early, bright October morning.
Thank you very much, Kurt. I hope that you all understand that I'm quite unbiased with anything that I have to say about Aldo Leopold. So with that in mind, I have to tell you that Aldo Leopold has filled my life with joy, with excitement, and with love and respect for the land. My father was a man who was intensely in love with the land. His love was deep, complicated, grown of joy and grief and passion. However could one live in a family with these feelings without trying to understand them as well as assimilate them? So today, as I reach back and look forward, I have better perspective on how my father operated as a father, as a companion, and as a writer. With fewest possible words and with his own actions, he presented to us a rare and wonderful philosophy. Let us think about how Leopold's legacy has evolved and where we can see it growing and growing into the future. Some 50 years ago, Aldo Leopold wove various ideas together into a memorable fabric he called the Land Ethic. This essay has become a central vision for many of us, bringing together scientists, philosophers, journalists, and laymen. He provides a clear link between science and ethics, between our understanding of ecosystems and our actions that affect their health. In this essay, he asserts that we are members of a community of interdependent parts, to include not just humans and plants, but animals, soils, lakes, rivers, oceans, collectively the land. Now, the emerging evidence of climate change requires us once more to think of Leopold's assertion that we are members of a community of interdependent parts. Climate change involves the whole global community, all countries, all bodies of water, and collectively, all lands. If China burns too much coal, the release of CO2 affects the rest of the world. If America loses its forests and prairies, less carbon dioxide is sequestered and more nitrous oxide is released. If Costa Rica removes all of its old growth forests to make pasture lands, CO2 builds up across the globe. It is a global problem. It is important to build public understanding that climate change is real, that it is global, and that working together as a global community is imperative. Leopold, the writer, early realized that good journalism is fundamental to informing the public. If we are serious about a problem and how to begin to solve it, journalists around the world are important and essential tool in helping society deal with it. Writing in 1933, Leopold was discussing the carrying capacity of the land. What is the maximum population density that the land is capable of supporting without degrading the whole system? Today, the poverty-stricken of the world have become solid evidence of human populations exceeding the carrying capacity of the land, not just Haiti and the arid countries of the Middle East and Mexico, but also of the United States. Will Leopold's understanding of carrying capacity help us face the problem with good science and ethics? Now, more than ever, journalists have an opportunity to get people to think and to act. In his lifetime, Leopold was exposed to the beauty and richness of the agricultural land and the natural landscape. In The Good Oak, he writes, there are two spiritual dangers in not owning a farm. One is the danger of supposing that breakfast comes from the grocery store, and the other, that heat comes from the furnace. Today, the growth of industrialization and the loss of biodiversity has had and will have profound effects on global life. Biodiversity is at the core of many issues we have been treating separately, such as pollution, species extinction, and global warming. With worldwide loss of biodiversity, natural ecosystems are threatened, and there is an increase in disease, such as Lyme disease, the H1N1 flu, white fungus on bats, and so forth. In 1940, Leopold wrote, we might get better advice from our economists and philosophers if we gave them a truer picture of the biotic mechanism. Was he asking for help from journalists? Recognition of this broader community, the interdependence of the global community, carries with it a commitment to coexist with the diverse natural entities. This in turn implies a profound alteration in our consumption habits and standard of living expectations. Leopold said it well. Our bigger and better society is now like a hypochondriac, so obsessed with its own economic health as to have lost the capacity to remain healthy. Economists and political leaders everywhere continue to endorse the illusion that more people consuming more resources is the road to prosperity. A shift in values to counteract the contemporary episode of consumerism is our challenge. Now, 50 years after Leopold, we are still in a world of competing values and interests. Leopold recognized the importance of journalists in bringing ideas to the public arena. This is illustrated by his own journalism efforts. Between 1919 and 1924, he established a little journal for the Forest Service called The Pine Cone. And in this publication, he was able to reach out to members of the Forest Service to make them more aware of the issues of the day. President Roosevelt even sent him a personal letter of congratulations. So in order to change both governmental policy and public attitudes and behaviors, we must develop a campaign dedicated to both. We must act as an environmental ethics that can reach into public diversity, public discourse. In short, let me ask you journalists three questions. One, can we retool a connection to the land through education? Two, can our economists and our political leaders recognize our absolute dependence on the natural world? And three, can we supplement political expediency with ethics, science, and understanding? While our environmental policy and traditions offer some basis for optimism, the forces of population growth, of industrialization and urbanization are daunting. We need your help in reaching the people. As our understanding of Leopold's land ethic is evolving, the need to apply it necessitates education and public involvement. And I say one good journalist can change history. Thank you.
I'm going to ask Carl if he would like to offer a rebuttal. You can come up or I can give you...
I'll just comment from here. I've been to many meetings and conversations involving Aldo Leopold, and this is the first time that I've been even aware of journalists expressing a concrete interest in Aldo Leopold and his teachings. I think it's marvelous, and congratulations.
The sequence I thought I might try to do here is from the personal to the professional to the broader literary and historical and cultural. So, Mike, if we can ask you to come up next.
Well, thank you. I can't tell you how humbled I am to be with a panel like this and wonder why I'm even up there. But it is an honor. And since most of you have heard me at least once before, some of you twice, I'll really try to be brief and really try to connect Aldo Leopold to the impact he's had on public policy. And in fact, Nina introduced the subject of his impact on public policy, and perhaps the best way to understand it, as I see it, is to paint a picture over time. If we go back to the time of the Revolutionary War and what people thought about land and how they used land, and I like to call it the tame and conquer era, where we had these obstacles of the forest as the European settlers, the agrarians, came over here, and there really wasn't a whole lot of room, especially in the Northeast and the East, to have a farm. So they basically had to clear the land. And it was something they literally had to conquer. As time moved on, land became purely a commodity. If you were a soldier in the War of 1812 and you were a private and you retired, you got 160 acres of land. You didn't get a monthly check like military retirees do today. If you were a lieutenant general in the War of 1812, you got 1,100 acres of land, and that was your pension and your livelihood. And we didn't have to have an income tax because we had land. We sold land to railroads and large corporations. And in fact, the stories are fascinating because there was a tremendous amount of graft and corruption involved in these land transactions, in these what is really 1.8 billion acres of land that is today the lower 48. We moved into an era that I like to call the utilitarian era that probably started about 1850, 1860, 1870, and really peaked with people like Gifford Pinchot, the first chief of the Forest Service, who saw the degraded landscape of the Appalachians and the cut-and-run era of the first major clear cuts and serious fires that were occurring at that time, and we had to fix it. And we began to apply science, but a lot of a human energy that humans could make it better, that we could always improve upon nature. And we did that through the Dust Bowl era with the CCCs, as you saw earlier in a presentation here today. And enter Alda Leopold, trained as a forester at Yale, very much in a utilitarian philosophy of Gifford Pinchot, but yet as he moved to the Southwest, he began to observe the landscape and the changes on the landscape and the impacts of grazing, and he began to see more and more that there was more to this than that. His work here at the Arboretum that you heard about a little bit earlier and so on began to move us toward what today we call, and I call, the third phase that we're in, and that's the era of ecosystem management. Some call it holistic management. Some call it watershed management. But call it what you will, but the things that Leopold really brought to this were putting the human element as part of it, but not necessarily the controller of it, in a utilitarian sense, but a level of humility as the humble individual in the impacts and relationships with the land. And now, and time continues to move on. And let me just relate that to what I see in the wildlife professionals, the foresters, the managers, and we're somewhere in this transition, still going back and forth, but yet in my years with the Department of Interior and the Forest Service, we really see, starting in the 1960s, the 1970s, as the agencies began to embrace concepts of ecosystem management, only we really didn't start calling it that until maybe the late 1980s, 1990s, and people like Secretary Bruce Babbitt, who Jamie Workman worked for. And in fact, I remember Jamie's story about when he first applied for the job with Secretary Babbitt. The example that he used in his application was, well, what would he write about communications? Well, it was the Sand County Almanac, right? And that got Jamie the job as Secretary Babbitt's communications director. So I think that's a good, as an example, as a demonstration of the impact that Leopold has had in public policy that goes way beyond the influence of professionals. Because initially, for example, in the Forest Service, there were sort of two camps. You know, there was the utilitarian camp and the Pinchot camp, and then they begin to see as the greatest good for the greatest number for the long run began to evolve, there was another dimension as the Pinchot philosophy began to be more and more influenced by the Leopoldian philosophy, and today we're embracing ecosystem management as where we need to be going. And I think the thing that expands it even further, as Nina mentioned, is climate change. And now the talk about sustainability and the fact that these are global challenges that we are facing. They're not local challenges. And as I said on Wednesday night, and I'll close with this statement, that, you know, I believe Leopold gave us the best, most common sense definition of sustainability. And that's the oldest task in human history, is living on a piece of land without spoiling it. Thank you.
As I bring up the third of our panelists. I want to remind everybody to please turn off your cell phone. I forgot to do that earlier. Please do that. Or as my friend calls them, your pocket crickets. I'm going to introduce Wendell Berry with a 30-second story. I should have done this maybe at the outset, but let me do it by referencing a conversation I recently had. I got a message from a friend who said, I'm doing a project on the history of dairy farming in Wisconsin, and I'd like to come and talk to you about Aldo Leopold. He said, I didn't know Leopold had anything to do with farming, but I started talking to all these old farmers in Wisconsin, and they started telling me about Aldo Leopold. I said, well, yeah, I'll tell you more about that if you come up. And we had a long conversation about it. But I'm referencing one farmer in particular whom we lost just... Now you get my point. Referencing one farmer who we lost just actually about 2 years ago, a fellow named Ed Klesig. Ed Klesig became a legend among Wisconsin farmers for many reasons. He took... It's like ethereal angels coming to... Ed Klesig in 1937 took Aldo Leopold's short course in wildlife management. He was not alone. There were a lot of young farm kids in the 1930s who came through this campus in Madison and encountered this professor who was at the front edge of conservation thought. And many of those farmers went on to go back to their farms, their small towns in Wisconsin, and make Wisconsin not just a place where the university spoke about the land ethic, but where people all across the state from many walks of life spoke and represented the land ethic. Ed Klesig became a legend later on. He lived in eastern Wisconsin, and he had a four-lane highway planned through his farm, and he did not take it sitting down. He brought a herd of dairy cows up to the state capitol, had them grazing on the state capitol lawn, and sold the manure to support the cause. This was Ed Klesig, and this was the land ethic in action. And I say that because I think it's an appropriate way to welcome Wendell Berry.
Our great historian in Kentucky, Tom Clark, found a picture of the governor's mansion about a little before the Civil War when the governor was a man named Moffett. And the remarkable thing in that picture is that the family cow was grazing on the lawn at the governor's mansion. Well, if we could put a cow on the lawn of every governor's mansion in this country, it would change the perspective of a lot of governors, especially if they'd get up and milk in the morning. Well, I thank you for inviting me to take part in this. I took part with this same group last year. I don't know whether this is habit forming or not. Is journalism a habit? But I enjoyed it very much, found you congenial company, and I'm grateful to be asked back. Recently, because I promised to do a little job of work for Kurt Miney, and because I knew this was coming up, I've been rereading this Ann County Almanac. When I first read it, it was a revelation and a confirmation. And I've grown so much smarter since the last time I read it from cover to cover that I'm just amazed at how it's improved. But I suppose one of the points I want to make is that this is a book for rereading. I think Aldo Leopold was a landmark man. Not that I can imagine him getting up one day and saying, well, I'm going to become a landmark man. I think he was too preoccupied with the things he loved. And I'm grateful to Nina for introducing that word into this conversation. But rereading him reminded me of a story that Wes Jackson tells. Our mutual friend, the Amish farmer and bishop, David Klein, told Wes, "I first read Aldo Leopold while I was plowing." And Wes said, "Oh, you mean you read him when you rested your horses?" Well, David said, "I did that at first. But finally, I got so interested, I just read and plowed at the same time." Well, he was a monumental man, and we know he was because he wrote a monumental book. And from that book, without his ever being too explicit about it, he comes across as a whole man, a man astonishingly whole and intact. He did love the land, and that every sentence is vibrant with that love. But he loved his family too, and that is right there always, apprehensible just in the language. He loved his dogs, and that always recommends a person. Aldo Leopold used that word, the environment, which I think was a word that belonged to the ecological vocabulary, and he used it in that way. But in his writing, environment is always embodied. The word, and I'm aware of the name of this organization when I began to speak of this, that word, I think, since 1948, has become a dangerous word. It's an abstraction. Nobody's ever seen the environment. Nobody could love it. It's really easy to hear too much about it. I remember a long time ago, I thought, if I ever hear that word environment again, I'm just going to throw up. And it's because we have become, by way of our educational system, a people who love abstractions and who love big solutions and big talk. What informs that word in the Sand County Almanac and in the other writings, too, is a love of country. This was a man who really liked to be on his feet in the landscape. And all this knowledge that he had keeps coming to the service of his vision. By which I mean, first of all, his actual sight of the land and its creatures that was right in front of him. So one of our tasks, I think, as writers, and I mean you journalists too, is to keep these abstractions embodied in our work. He's a fine writer, and I think it's for that reason that he's always, even when he's talking about ethics, somehow you feel that this springs from this background of particular knowledge of a lot of country that he had taken the trouble to know well. The wholeness of the man is there in the writing. And I don't know how exactly you're going to fit this idea of wholeness into journalism. But I think as you go about your work, you're going to have to keep that possibility in mind. The prose of, say, the Sand County Almanac has an enormous range. He was a considerable poet from time to time, and that's there in that prose. He was a man of science, and real knowledge is always informing the prose. So that whole range, from a highly cultivated sensibility to a highly knowledgeable, factual vocabulary, all that is there. And I don't think any of us could have a better model for writing about this issue that we've learned to call to our detriment, I think, the environment. Now, he was a conservationist. And, of course, that's the cause that brings us together. And this is the kind of conservatism to which we all are called. One of the riddles of our age is how you can be a conservative without being a conservationist. It just goes to show you how useless our present-day political vocabulary is. How can you be a conservative without wanting to conserve things? And maybe we're going to have to ask, how can you be a liberal without wanting to conserve things? Because our freedom, which is the ground of liberalism, if it's going to have a ground, which it had better, our freedom rises up from the ground along with our sustenance, our lives. So Aldo Leopold was, to start with, and unsurprisingly, a wilderness conservationist. Obviously, the wilderness called forth a great love from him. And by being in the wilderness with this great motive of affection in his heart, he was led to ask certain questions like, what is it that happens to an old wolf when she dies? That's the a question that a mystic would ask, actually. There's a great sort of religious force in this writing at sometimes, and I'm pleased to notice on this reading that he did acknowledge the importance of Ezekiel and Isaiah, which puts him at odds, you know, with a lot of conservationists who would lay our sins all on the Bible. But what reassures me about his writing as a conservationist is his insistence, again, unsurprisingly, he was a whole man, on the wholeness of the land as an organism. And so the range of his conservation interest extended directly, and by the surest logic, from the need to conserve wilderness to a need to conserve the economic landscapes. You can't build the forest and mine the farm. This is the head note to my own preoccupation and my quarrel with mainstream conservation in this country. People get tremendously excited about the idea of conserving a plot of wilderness. And we have literally let our economic landscapes go to hell. I'm a Kentuckian, as I told you last year, and I have been preoccupied ever since 1965 with this phenomenon of surface mining for coal, which has now graduated to mountaintop removal. Whole mountains with the whole biota, the whole living community of a mountain, plants and animals, the topsoil, the forest ecosystem, the streams, all turned upside down, destroyed for all practical purposes forever in order to get coal, which has no value except in that brief instant when it's on fire. So we dig it to destroy it, and in the process destroy everything else. And having destroyed it, we live with both the residue and the effects. So it pleases me very much to know that Leopold was a wilderness conservationist. Of course it does. I love wilderness to the extent that I've seen it. But I'm not overly electrified, as you may know. But wilderness conservation is a relatively simple idea. What really challenges us, what humbles us and gets us down to our proper stature, is the question of how to use the lands that we must use. And so I take a tremendous reassurance and comfort from knowing that he and his family bought that old run-down, used-up farm out there and planted trees on it and lived on it and from it every minute they could and took excitement from it. And it pleases me also, I was talking with Buddy this morning and telling him how much it mattered to me that in these latter days, the forest having grown all these years, when they've needed timber, they've gone into the forest, their own forest, for it. We conservationists have learned to lump logging in with only the worst kind of forest use. We haven't learned to discriminate between good use and bad use. The poles of conservation have come to be the supposedly untouched wilderness, although we've touched it all, and the raped and pillaged economic landscapes. That just won't do. That's not going to last us. It's not going to keep us intelligent. It's not going to keep us excited. And it's not going to save the world, which I reckon we've got to do. we don't know a great deal about sustaining anything. We're a young people, still a juvenile people in a lot of ways. And when we talk about sustainability, we literally don't know what we're talking about, because we've not sustained anything. We haven't been here long enough to sustain anything reliably. But that woodland out there has now been subjected to careful, loving use is something that matters. Well, of course, we do have enormous challenges, global scale problems. But if we're going to have hope, if we're going to continue, I think we have to single out and study and love and revere these small projects of work that are exemplary. And so, all honor to Aldo Leopold, his family, and his place.
I have a shorthand way of summarizing a lot of this that Wendell reminded me of. Aldo Leopold is the only figure in our history who has a wilderness area named after him, a center for sustainable agriculture named after him. And to that, I usually use those two, but to the third I would add right now is the place where we are, the University of Wisconsin Arboretum. If that first institution stood for the wild, and the second stood for the kind of careful stewardship and loving stewardship that Wendell spoke of, this place where you are this morning speaks to a third important strand in the history of conservation, of restoration, of using our tools and our caring ethic to restore what we have lost, at least to some degree, and to focus on the health of it. This is the unique legacy of Leopold. When I look back on my own work on Leopold and see how he combined these at a personal level, at a professional level, and at a cultural level. So with that, I hope we have enough time. If someone can remind me of how much time we have, about 15 minutes. And I'll ask you, if you're interested in asking our panel a question, to make it as short as possible so that we can have as many as possible. And if you could direct it to one of the speakers in particular, that's the first hand I saw. So.
Thank you. I'm Kim Kastens from Columbia University. We heard Nina mention the two dangers of not owning a farm, and we heard other comments about the importance of strength, of love and attachment to the land. But in modern society, the desire to own a bit of one's own land has morphed into a suburban land use pattern where we have tiny plots of land where each household is striving to own its own piece of land. So do you think a change of ethic is needed to help people let go of the desire to own a piece of land? And if so, what strategies might you offer to achieve such a change of ethic?
Well, I think that is a fundamental question. I think those of us who have had this experience of owning land are indeed privileged. We really can, with our urban society, as you say, it's not an easy deal. So I think this is one of our major problems. If you have no contact with the land, how can you understand our dependence on the land? So maybe Carl could answer this better than I could. Carl?
Mm-hmm. You said it nicely, Nina. That's beautiful. That's right on. How can we enjoy it if we don't even know it's there?
Oh. Let me say something. Please. Well, the idea of land ownership is a rather flimsy idea because we're mortal and we're not going to be here very long. So it's a great privilege to own land. It's also a terrible and terrifying responsibility. But what's happening in this country through the farmers markets and the CFA, the community CSA, community supported agriculture farms, and those things is we're growing now in the cities, a kind of urban agrarian population, and they are giving proxies to farmers and others to produce for them, but more and more knowledgeably, they're supervising those proxies. And so, you know, your connection with the land is alimentary. And people begin to know that and experience a kind of relief and a kind of pleasure in eating food that hasn't cost too much.
Actually, I want to tell a story about Nina because she's too humble to tell this story. She and I were at the podium in 1999 or 98 in this town at the Leopold Conference, and she was asked the question, what was it like to be a little girl growing up with your father and at the shack? And her answer was really very simple. She said, that's where we learned to love each other and love nature. And that's one place we really need to push society today to reconnect with nature.
I just want to add a note to exactly what Wendell said. I was going to bring this up on my own, that the power of the food movement as it's growing right now is it's not just dependent on rural places, and it's food that is connecting people back to land, even if they're in cities. But all these other issues, health, water, climate. An email I had this week from a friend, he says, I'm so intrigued by that conversation we had about an urban land ethic, new urbanism, the things going on in sustaining cities. Are these parts of the land ethic? In my view, they certainly are, and it's one of the new directions that we have to let the land ethic evolve so that people who are not going to own land, but maybe they'll volunteer at the arboretum or on a piece of public land that Mike might have managed once or in their own local park or backyard. And it's some of the most exciting work going on in the conservation arena right now. And I hope those of you who went over to Growing Power in Milwaukee, you saw one of the premier examples of it. And it's not only bringing the urban audience in, it's bringing very different constituencies, different groups of people who haven't shared the same land ethic in such a personal way, but have opportunities now to contribute.
Okay. Wendell Berry. Following the overwhelming opposition to the USDA's National Animal Identification System that was expressed in the listening sessions, including your own very impassioned statement in Kentucky, how do you see that the USDA could change to support these new food pathways? And do you think that that's what's going on? Oh, I'm sorry. It's Christine Heinrichs. I'm a freelance journalist.
Well, I could say a lot of things that I don't know in response to that question. But I think the USDA is beginning to wake up a little bit. There's great inertia involved in government, and the alliance between the USDA and corporate agriculture is going to be hard to break into. I did go to Washington as a bodyguard for Wes Jackson and Fred Kirschenman to introduce this thing we're calling the 50-year farm bill. And we actually talked to Kathleen Merrigan, and she received us very graciously and had her staff on hand to question. So the odd thing that's going on now is that this effort at responsible agriculture and responsible eating is being led from the bottom by people who've simply seen what needed to be done and have set about to doing it without official permission or approval or help. They're just going on and doing it. So what we're looking at is a situation in which the leaders, maybe in 10 years, will have caught up with the lead. Well, things are happening faster than I thought they were going to in that line. But what I wish journalists would do would be quit looking at the top and start really paying attention to what's going on at the bottom. We've had a really vigorous effort in Kentucky to supplant tobacco with a diversity of other crops and products. And the media have completely ignored it. They don't know what's going on. The state and national leadership don't know it's happening, but it's happening.
This question is, I'm Jordan Fisher Smith. I'm a freelancer from the Sierra Nevada. I guess I'm directing this question at Mike Dombeck. You, in the course of your remarks, you characterized the two strands of modern conservation as those of Gifford Pinchot and, strangely, Aldo Leopold. And not too many years ago, those two strands were identified as John Muir's and Gifford Pinchot's. And I'm curious whether there has been a change now in the environmental movement to embrace more of an engagement with the land rather than a hands-off, and to and whether this might have something to do with the growing stature of Aldo Leopold. I see him eclipsing John Muir right now as a sort of spiritual forebear for the maybe the more hardcore environmental movement.
Interestingly, that's a topic that we had a significant dialogue on at this conference with another group, a small group, and that obviously, we can place things, categorize people and things, but if you put the utilitarians and the preservationists on a spectrum, and Muir, of course, was a very prominent player in the public policy debate, as well as Pinchot was in the Roosevelt era and in that time frame. And then you ask yourself, well, what dimension did Leopold add to that? I think number one is the fact that people were part of that and having a significant impact on that, and perhaps as he learned more and observed more, realized that we needed more humility and in a sense lighter on the land, but realizing we were going to be there. And even though much of the concept of wilderness and the Wilderness Act, at least while he was employed by the Forest Service in the early 20s, was based upon observations and the proposals that he made that resulted in the first, at least administratively, set aside wilderness. So that's sort of how I see this fitting together with the more holistic view that Leopold injected in the debate, that in fact didn't really start gaining a lot of momentum until after the Rachel Carson era, and much more so when we had the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act, and many of the other places where we started focusing on a more holistic point of view. Leopold's began to be embraced more and more, and I think policymakers, ecologists, scientists really began to understand the real value and the dimension that he added to this thinking and philosophy.
Okay. Thank you all for your wonderful comments, and I love the fact that you've been embracing the holistic view and also the historic view, looking at the land that way. And the point about the place of human beings in relation to the land, I wanted to ask about population and the demographic trend of aging in our population. And I wanted to, we think of the environmental movement as being this youth, it starts with youth. But I wanted to ask you about the place of elders in pushing forward the land ethic and environmental thinking. And, of course, I can't help but notice that the SCJ population is aging as well. But I'm Francesca Lyman, and I'm an environmental writer, freelance writer.
Good.
No. As the youngest of this panel, I'm just going to start it so that there won't be so shy. But as a, when I was working on Leopold's biography, I was in my 20s. And it was, for me, just an immersion into wisdom. And it was both the people I got to meet and interview and work with, but also the people I was able to read. And ever since then, I've had that. And there was a very strong a commitment in my mind at that time, because a lot of Leopold's contemporaries were in their 70s, 80s, 90s. Howell's younger brother, Fritz, was 89 years old at the time, and he had pneumonia. So Nina, I remember, said, "You better go talk to Uncle Fritz right away." And the point of that was to, and it gets back to Wendell's comments about understanding the relationship between the older conservation movement, the modern environmental movement, and then this emerging movement, or anti-movement or non-movement or whatever, in distrust of movements, to quote Wendell Berry again. But what it allowed me to do at that point as a young person was to get beyond the horizon of baby boom environmentalism and understand that there was an older tradition and a lot of shoulders that we stood on. Didn't mean the older conservationists had it all right. But it did allow me to reconnect to an older generation, but to see the relevance of what they were saying, especially prior to World War II, in the new age of my generation. So I guess I would take your question and just tweak it a little bit and ask all of you, if you would like to say a comment or two about, again, how you look upon the generations coming and understand the need to connect to those older traditions without being necessarily accepting of all of it, but being critical and understanding how younger folks can get a bearing under in uncertain times.
Oh, dear me. Well, I see, to answer just part of the question, which will be enough for me, I think that older people are probably valuable among other things, but you know, it's possible to like some of them. But their usefulness is that they have been around long enough to have a more detailed and sense of consequence than younger people. Young people have the blessed gift of feeling that the world is as it has always been. And we who have been around a while know that it is not as it has always been. And we run a bit of a risk with this, and that's the risk of being nostalgic about the good old days. But the good old days were better. And I'm going to be objective about this. They were demonstrably better because there was just a lot more topsoil when I started out than there is now. When I was a kid working on the farm and the weather was wet enough, we didn't take a water jug to the field. We drank out of wet weather springs. You just don't do that anymore. We swam in every hole that was deeper than 18 inches, in every creek. But you don't do that anymore. We don't have a safely swimmable stream in Kentucky anymore. We don't have a stream from which you can safely eat the fish. So don't be too quick to judge us of sentimentality when we say that we remember better times.
I can't add to that.
Go ahead.
Do we have time for one more?
One more.
One more question, if there is one.
I'm Mark Schlefstein with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, and being from New Orleans, I am dealing every day with catastrophic risk. I guess I'm struggling to see where the personal philosophy of Leopold, and also you, Wendell, you've also dealt a little bit with catastrophic risk, but how that can be moved into the debate over, you know, these key issues that are coming out in Louisiana, especially with having to rebuild entire coastlines. How do you deal with that?
But then you can comment. We're in your watershed. What happens in Wisconsin and Iowa and Minnesota affects what happens at the mouth of the Mississippi River. What we have done with our agricultural landscape has amazing consequences for the Gulf dead zone, for the loss of wetlands. We are tied in ecologically, economically, physically to what goes on downstream. When we flooded last year in Wisconsin, and Nina remembers that well, we were devastated in the part of the county just north of Madison where I live. And I was frustrated because out of that, here in Wisconsin, where we like to lay claim to a strong conservation ethic, there was no discussion in the aftermath of these devastating floods we had last year and in Iowa next door to the concept of having to manage land in a way that promotes resilience, that allows you to, you're not going to remove risk, but you can prepare and manage your land in a way that keeps it resilient. It was a story that the media missed. It was a story that Midwestern leaders missed and national leaders. To make those connections, to say that the issues of New Orleans and Katrina are connected to the agricultural and cultural issues of the upper Midwest. And it was very frustrating because we did not have the conversation we should have had to say, how can we moderate our land use so that we can at least reduce risk and promote the resilience of the land and the human economies and communities in our region, so that we can at least prepare for climate change, prepare for the other large-scale issues that we're looking at in the future. It didn't happen. It's up to us to help make that happen.
You downstream journalists really need to wake up and pay attention, because you're critical people. To be downstream, to be in New Orleans is the ultimate. That's the wrong word. Terminal downstream, downstream people. But you're right between that whole Mississippi drainage that's sending all those agricultural chemicals down, and on the other side of you is that dead zone in the Gulf. But I'm a downstream person. I live at mile 13 on the Kentucky River. And one of the deprivations that I most suffer from is that willows don't grow along the Kentucky River anymore. That river heads up in the coal fields. It runs, it picks up the effluent from central Kentucky cities. And when it goes by my house, I have no idea what's in it. But where that assembles, I have, Tanya and I have a little place at the bottom of the Cane Run watershed. And that's where you find refrigerators, hair dryers, all these personal makeup big containers and so on. All that winds up down there in our fields. So you know it.
That's right. I think that the problem in New Orleans is a perfect example of the fact that we are not separate entities. New Orleans is completely related to what's going on at our place, at Wendell's place. It is the interrelatedness of the natural system that should govern the way that we handle land. And I think New Orleans was an example that we should have used for education, and I don't think we did.
And also, of course, the New Orleans episode, it's a good place to conclude. In 2005, on Labor Day weekend, or it was around there, I was in St. Louis for the White House Conference on Cooperative Conservation. Big national meeting. A couple of my colleagues who are here were there also. And on the second day of the conference, with all the secretaries from all the federal departments in St. Louis, the announcement came that the levees of New Orleans had burst. And I don't know that anyone at that conference was perceptive enough to make the connections at the time, but sitting there on the banks of the Mississippi River, a few of us took a little time out to say, I think this is a little larger issue than we're addressing here. And it gets me to a point, obviously, that it's not just an ecological issue or an economic issue, it's an environmental justice issue as well. And that we are connected by the land, we are also connected by the social contract of being citizens. And I want to end up with a line that I've often used, and those of you who heard my presentation the other night, I noticed that I will use it again. I've called this the most important sentence Aldo Leopold ever wrote. I don't say that lightly, having read almost all of them. But it's actually a couple sentences. I'll use the longer version. It comes toward the end of the land ethic, and I'm just going to try to do it from memory. So Leopold says, nothing so important as an ethic is ever written. No one supposes that Moses wrote the Ten Commandments. It was the product of a social community, and Aldo just wrote a summary for a seminar. And then he went on to say, an ethic evolves in the minds of a thinking community. I call it the most important sentence Leopold wrote because, think of it, in an essay called The Land Ethic, Leopold says, no one writes an ethic. It's a stroke of genius because with it he liberated the land ethic. He says, it's not mine. It's not even my family's ethic. It is our community's ethic, and that community can include anyone. And in fact, it obligates everyone to participate, to bring to it what their cultural background, what their traditions have to say about evolving human relationships with the land. And that includes you. I know journalists are supposed to be and are objective when they're doing their job, but you are also members of community as citizens, as communicators. And so you, too, have an obligation to think about how this ethic has to grow and evolve in the future. What does it mean, especially as the media environment itself is evolving at a breakneck pace in a direction none of us understands? It's going to be a difficult challenge for us all. But because we do have wonderful elders and leaders like the panel, it helps us to keep our bearings. So with that, I want to thank everybody here for joining us and give our panel a hand. Thank you.